This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
See here, so from one end of the institute, the other ends of the institute are in the lab areas. Yeah, so that means that the women are not allowed to enter this part. They're only allowed to stay on the other side behind these doors.
One Austrian research center has created a pregnancy lab as a way to support expectant scientists. Hey there, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, biogas, organic waste turned into natural gas that generates electricity, is booming in Germany and across the continent.
This is a big vessel where all fluids are delivered. In this case, that would be the manure. In other words, liquid animal excrement.
Plus, an interview with a Slovakian startup that's been helping the local online media make some cash. But first, the latest on autonomous vehicle research. All that and more this week on Spectrum. If you've been listening to Spectrum since last summer, you may remember that we had a series of interviews with Alberto Broggi, an Italian researcher in autonomous driving. He headed a research project to drive an autonomous vehicle from Parma, Italy, to Shanghai, China, by last fall. Autonomous driving has really been heating up, not just in Europe, but in North America, too. In fact, just last week, after some lobbying from Google, the American state of Nevada has become the first region of the United States to authorize autonomous cars on public roads. Earlier this month, Broggi and many more of the world's top researchers into these robotic cars gathered at a conference in Baden-Baden in southern Germany to share their latest results. Kate Hairsine reports.
7 years ago, the U.S. Defense Research Agency, DARPA, created a desert road race for self-driving vehicles. The race was tough. Not one of the 15 competitors made it to the finish line. Things have vastly improved since then, though. Today, rigged out with video cameras, radar sensors or laser rangefinders, test cars are able to drive themselves through real city traffic.
It's a very surreal experience at first because you're sitting in the driver's seat and so you're so used to having to control everything. And then all of a sudden the steering wheel is turning by itself and the gas is being pressed by itself. And then all of a sudden you start getting comfortable and you say, wait a second, and my car's driving and hey, it's actually doing a really good job.
That's Jesse Levinson from Stanford University in the United States. He was recently in the southwestern German town of Baden-Baden to give a paper at an international symposium on intelligent vehicles.
We have new algorithms for perception and specifically object classification.
He says autonomous cars are now better than humans at doing many things on the road.
It's even more accurate at staying in the center of the lane, and it's able to detect when a car in front of you brakes even faster than a human. So it can also sense behind itself better than humans.
Despite their high-tech equipment, though, self-driving vehicles still fail dismally in certain situations. In extremely heavy rain or incredibly dusty conditions, for example, the cameras just can't see the road. It is possible to circumvent this with special sensors called laser radar sensors, or LADARs for short. This is because LADARs don't need to see, rather they scan and process the echoes bounced off targets. But LADAR brings difficulties of its own, explains Alberto Broggi from the University of Parma.
It's getting pretty common to have one of these quite expensive sensors on top of your car that is able to see everything around you, in front, in the back, on the sides, very far away. And the problem is to process this data because it's a huge amount of data. And you have to understand every single echo from this system and classify that.
Last year, Alberto Broggi's research team tested an autonomous vehicle over a staggering 30,000 kilometres, taking it from Italy to China. Broggi says that the logical computers driving the car were completely overwhelmed when the humans around them drove chaotically, a common scenario in cities from Moscow to Shanghai. This is why artificial intelligence researchers like Broggi are now focusing on improving the way the data from the sensors is processed. But the data itself can be overwhelming.
We secured some 20,000 hours on the largest supercomputer in Italy. So now we have a huge amount of data because we collected every single bit that came out from the sensors and from the GPS and from radios.
Brogi expects to spend the next 3 years at his desk crunching numbers.
The idea is to process the whole data, find out where it didn't work, and then go back to the laboratory and fix the issues, fix the software, make changes, and then process them again. And maybe, hopefully, you get a smaller amount of data in which the system does not work. And then you start working on that again. So we will process and process and process again the same data until we get some software that can really process everything 100% reliable.
But while completely autonomous cars are still in the testing phase, some spin-offs can already be found in commercially available vehicles.
Okay, so we have different scenarios here where I can show you the different assistance systems that we have.
At the Intelligent Vehicle Conference, Mercedes engineer Joachim Happ takes people on a drive in a simulator, showing them the so-called driver assist technology that's already available in top-end Mercedes cars.
My desire is to drive fast, for example, 150 kilometers an hour, and there's a car ahead of me only driving 120. My car autonomously reduces the speed by throttling the engine or, if necessary, even braking by itself. If the driver unattentively leaves the lane, we already have in today's cars an algorithm pushing the driver back into his or her desired lane. It pulls her back safe until you don't have a crash.
Many German car makers such as Daimler, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen and Audi, and companies associated with the automotive industry such as Bosch, have been quietly pushing this type of research in Europe. With some serious money being thrown at the technology, as well as backing from Google, who's testing its own fleet of autonomous cars in the United States, experts predict it won't be too long before self-driving vehicles hit the streets. Kate Hairsine, Deutsche Welle Radio, Baden-Baden.
Autonomous cars are just one scientific field that's been hotting up in Germany these days. And there's another one that's so hot it generates actual electricity. Of course, I'm talking about biogas. That's the kind of fuel created from plant and animal waste that can be turned into usable power. In fact, the number of biogas plants in Germany has more than tripled in the last 6 years. That's largely due to a renewable energy subsidy from the government. Today, in Germany, there's already about 6,000 of these huge digesters, and they're continuing to grow at a rapid pace. In fact, just last week, an Austrian company announced that it would be building a biogas plant to generate enough electricity for thousands of households in the western German town of Marle. Kate Laycock takes a closer look at biogas in Germany.
Biogas takes all kinds of organic waste. Cow manure, chicken manure, slaughterhouse waste, straw, grass, corn, and turns them into fuel. When bacteria break down these substances, one of the main products is methane, or natural gas, which can be used as fuel and electricity. But before it gets there, it starts in a pit, says Waldemar Gruber, a biogas expert with the Ministry of Agriculture in Düsseldorf, the capital of the state of North Rhine-Westphalia.
This is a big vessel where all fluids are delivered. In this case, that would be the manure. In other words, liquid animal excrement.
This comes from cattle and swine manure. And right next to that, solids are delivered. In Germany, that means mostly waste from corn plants.
In a way, we're making sauerkraut. We take plant material with a sugar component. We solidify this by driving over it with heavy vehicles to push the air out. Then there's a process of lactic acid fermentation, and all of it can be kept for years here.
For use in a bioplant, however it comes, all of that waste, along with the manure, is then fed into a digester.
The solids are brought into an auger system. The slurry is pumped into the fermenter.
This fermenter looks like a huge round pot, about the size of an apartment building, with green plastic tarp as a cover. Right next to it is a secondary fermenter, which looks just about the same. That's where the second fermentation stage takes place.
Over the digester, we've got a gas membrane, and over that is a canvas for weather protection. The gas membrane is located on a beam construction, which prevents the membrane from falling onto the digested sludge.
Auf den Faulschlamm fällt, ja?
In these two pots, various bacteria decompose the biomass into its components. In the absence of air, the bacteria here can be broken down into its organic compounds, including, most significantly, methane. But an unwanted byproduct of the fermentation of proteins is also hydrogen sulfide.
Und dieses H2S? This is undesirable because it could lead to corrosion. Therefore, we must eliminate the hydrogen sulfide by blowing air into the gas storage area. Then so-called purple sulfur bacteria feed on it and produce elemental sulfur.
And this ends up, along with all other non-fermented materials, in the so-called digestate, a substance which will be later used as fertilizer on fields and farmlands. The digestate worries some scientists, however. That's because if it gets contaminated with pathogens, then they might infect crops and eventually animals and humans. Some experts have speculated that biogas may have led to the recent E. coli outbreak in Germany. The German Biogas Association has denied such a possibility. Still, there is reason for concern, according to Helga Bernl, a Göttingen-based veterinarian.
The fermentation substrate which comes out of this system back there, yes, that is bacterial protein. When they are released into the wild and then accumulate in the soil, this digestate does contain a much higher concentration of nutrients that are important to Clostridia.
Back in Düsseldorf, the Ministry of Agriculture also operates an experimental co-generation biogas plant where the biogas can be used as fuel to generate power and the waste heat can also be captured to heat water and the building itself. That's according to technician Frederik Meppen.
All the buildings here are heated by the biogas plant, but there is an emergency backup in case something doesn't work so that we can still continue to heat up.
Biogas plants are continuing to get more and more attention across Europe, although still on a relatively small scale. Just last month, a new biogas plant, which is now heating 1,200 homes, just came online in neighbouring Luxembourg. And later this year, the town of Oberrosfer, about 200 kilometres east of Düsseldorf, is set to begin converting its biogas into electricity for 850 residents by November. Kate Laycock, Deutsche Welle Radio.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And of course, we bring you the latest program details for DW TV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the internet at dwworld.de.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Saruz Farivar. Remember, if you can't get to a radio when Spectrum comes on in your area, don't worry. You can listen anytime at dw-world.de/spectrum via streaming audio or as a podcast. Both are really easy and completely free to access. You can also follow SciTech updates and get a preview of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_SciTech. We're just over about 880 followers now, and it would be great to break 1,000 by the end of the summer. Help us out, would you? Coming up, Austria's pregnant-only science lab. But first, here's Nicole Goebel with the news.
On Monday, Dutch and British public health officials advised their citizens to avoid eating raw sprouts and seeds, as a German E. coli outbreak has now been linked to France. Over the weekend, 7 people in the Bordeaux area in western France have been hospitalised after eating infected sprouts. French officials have confirmed that at least 2 of these people have been infected by the rare and lethal strain of E. coli that has emerged from northern Germany over the last month. Figures from the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, which monitors disease in the region, have shown that over 3,600 people have been infected in Germany, which have led to the deaths of 42 people in Germany and 1 in Sweden. In other biological news, scientists have finally been able to determine what the 5,000-year-old Iceman ate for his last meal before he passed away. Ötzi, as he's commonly known, was found frozen in the Italian Alps 20 years ago, and scientists have been studying him ever since. In a new paper presented at the 7th World Congress on Mummy Studies in San Diego, California, scientists unveiled new evidence that Ötzi ate cooked wild goat meat and some cereals just 2 hours before he died. The researchers also found that Ötzi's stomach also contained strands of animal hair and fly parts. One researcher told National Geographic magazine, "It wasn't the most hygienic of meals." And finally, Google has released its semi-annual figures about how many times private information about the company's users was requested by governments or local police. In just 6 months, Google revealed that such requests were made over 14,000 times by authorities from 26 different countries. On Monday, the company said that various EU countries were amongst the most frequently requested, and that includes Italy, Germany and the UK. Google said in a note that the Office of Fair Trading had requested the removal of fraudulent scams and that the company had removed over 93,000 items in total.
Nicole Goebel with the news there. Throughout Europe, nearly 60% of science graduates are women, but that number is progressively chipped away as we move up the professional ladder. Only 18% of women reach a professorial level in academia, according to the European Commission. There are several reasons behind this drop, but a big one is the start of family life, and the shift begins with pregnancy. Female researchers find that once they are pregnant, many laboratory essentials such as mice or tetracycline become out of reach by law. Across Europe, country regulations err on the side of caution. That results in months of lost work and possibly a permanent blow to a woman's research and overall career. To work around the legal obstacles, one research center, the Institute of Molecular Biotechnology at the Austrian Academy of Sciences, or IMBA for short, has created what it calls the Pregnancy Lab. Shruti Pinnamaneni reports from Vienna.
First off, the Pregnancy Lab is not a common thing in Austria's science circles. It is, in fact, the only such lab that the people I spoke to in the government knew of. By Austrian law, pregnant women cannot work in spaces where they or others are handling chemicals or animals that may pose a risk to them. But in places like a biology center, this keeps the women out of pretty much every lab.
You can see here, so from one end of the institute, the other ends of the institute are in the lab areas. Yeah? So that means that the women are not allowed to enter this part. They're only allowed to stay on the other side, behind these doors.
That was Arabella Meisner, a scientist at IMBA and one of the people leading the pregnancy lab project. At some other institutes and universities in Austria, pregnant women simply hand off their research if it comes under the law's wide umbrella. When IMBA's directors saw their promising female scientists being moved from the lab to the back office, they created the Pregnancy Lab in 2008, an isolated space free of substances that pose even marginal risk. Again, here's Meisner.
When IMBA was then designed as an institute, Josef...
That's Josef Penninger, scientific director of IMBA.
Wanted to have this pregnant laboratory to show that we would really like to support young pregnant women, that they can do research and also get a family and not stopping their scientific career.
This is because IMBA, similar to other centers in the country, is stepping up efforts to make the institute more palatable to female scientists. The most recent Eurostat report on personnel showed that in Austria, less than 21% of researchers are women, one of the lowest levels in the EU. At 19%, Germany is even lower. Standing in the pregnancy lab at IMBA, it looks actually like any other lab. It's narrow and stocked with tubes and fridges and histology supplies, like a machine for slicing mouse tissue. The only sign that it's not any old lab is that the few researchers here all have bulging bellies. Vanya Naj, a neuroscience PhD student who used to work in the lab, says she faced a daunting bureaucracy here.
On a daily basis, I could run two or three small experiments, for example. So each one of them has to be evaluated by a committee. They have to assess all the chemicals that are being used and whether or not it's okay for you to use it. The committee meets once every couple of months, depending on necessity. So I had to wait for a month or two to even get the simplest things approved.
For young scientists, she says, those months were tough to lose.
to be forced to bring the whole operation to a halt is extremely frustrating and can be detrimental. You know, sometimes we're talking about a matter of weeks for you to put out a paper faster than somebody else that could make or break your career, and you have to be on top of it.
Naj says she appreciates that the Austrian laws are in place to protect her and her baby, but that they ended up feeling exaggerated and sometimes discriminatory. So should the laws be made narrower to do away with this cumbersome committee process? Not really, says Reinhild Pürgi, a chemist working at the Ministry of Social Affairs.
It is not so easy to say in a law that there is a chemical that is allowed and there is one that is not allowed, because you have to have a systematic approach, which is exactly the core principle of the European law as well.
The Austrian law is broad and sometimes interpreted differently by different institutions, but it is simply a reflection of EU labor regulations, though in many other countries, women are still allowed to work in the main lab as long as they are not the ones handling forbidden materials. But whether it's because of personal choice or resistant bureaucracy, this is the turning point where the number of women in scientific academia begins dropping, and it happens nearly everywhere in the EU. The European Commission calls this a waste of talent and money and has asked research centers to remove obstacles that act as direct or indirect discrimination against women. Imba hopes to eventually bring the women back into the main lab and shut down the pregnancy lab. In the meantime, Meisner and her colleagues are working with Pürgi from the government to categorize every scientific procedure and chemical to define those that are safe for pregnant women. They have also hired a technician to assist the women by handling hazardous animals and materials. The technician is male. Shruti Pinnamaneni, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
From the science lab to the business lab now, we turn to Slovakia. Earlier this year, a new Bratislava startup created a sort of online passport for media websites as a way to help generate new revenue for sagging print advertising. Just last week, Piano Media announced that 9 Slovakian media websites had netted 40,000 euros in the first month after some of their content was put behind a paywall. In April, Piano Media's new Piano Publishing platform started charging just under 3 euros a month for unlimited access to parts of these 9 Slovakian sites. To learn more about how the system works, I spoke with Piano Media head Tomáš Bela.
All right, so tell me about this paywall system that you have. What is it, and how did it get started?
Piano is a system for a united system for payments. People really don't have that much problem with paying for the content on the internet. What we try to do is to copy basically a cable TV model where you just pay once for all the programs, and you know that you won't be bothered with any other requirements for payments anymore. So we thought the problem with the payments for the content is really very inconvenient. We built the system in Slovakia where you only pay once, one fee of 2.19 to 90 per month, and regardless of on what side you pay, you get automatic access to all the other premium content in the country. So you don't have to pay again any other side, and you don't even have to log in again. You are automatically recognized as a paying user, and this removes most of the complexity from the reader, and then we do the system of dividing the money between the media where you actually spend your time after you paid.
So what happens if you don't pay? I mean, before this paywall system, I'm obviously not Slovakian, so I don't even know what's an example of a Slovakian newspaper or media website where you have this, and how can you kind of lay out for me how this worked before you had this system and then how it works now?
Currently, there are nine major media outlets in the system. They all have together there are about more than 30 different services. So some of them, most of them were free before. Two of them already asked readers to pay before Piano came. So basically, before you had to pay, for example, for the magazine Týždeň, you had to pay by SMS to access each issue online. If you didn't buy a print magazine, for example, all the broadsheet newspaper in Slovakia put in their opinion sections. Then there are, for example, some of them are publishing articles earlier for the paying users. Some of them you have to pay if you want to comment on articles and so on. There are quite a lot of different services.
How does this work, by the way? Do the websites, if they sign up, do they have to pay to be part of this service, or how does that work?
No, it's they don't pay anything. They only have to implement it technically, which takes a few days usually. So this is one of the reasons, of course, why they were willing to try this, because it's quite expensive for the media to build the payment system. New York Times talks about some $25 million or $50 million, how much it costed them to build their paywall. And I was laughing at this last year, and now I'm not laughing anymore, because it's really expensive. So the smaller media, many of them, at least here in Central Europe, were saying, yes, we don't really expect this will bring us any money, or we don't even expect that we will get the money that the system, be paid for the system back. They were purely as a defensive move, you know, to defend the print editions.
Now, I know in the U.S., I mean, that's the media, you know, landscape that I'm most familiar with. I know in the U.S. there's been kind of different ideas with paywalls and stuff, and most recently, as I'm sure you know, the newspaper, the New York Times, has just imposed a new kind of paying system where you have to, you get, I think it's 100 articles for free, and then you can pay to get more access. However, it's really easy to get around that system, even legally, because they want traffic from social media, from Facebook, from Twitter, and these things. And so all you have to do to get around this paywall is copy and paste the headline into Google News, click it, and there you go. I just did this just a few minutes before I came and talked to you on the phone. So I'm wondering, you know, how did these websites that presumably would like their articles to be shared and so forth, how do they deal with them being shared?
We agree with the basic idea of New York Times paywall, which is that only people who are the heaviest users of the site should be asked to pay. New York Times, I think they're saying that it's about 15%. And we are on the same page here. We didn't want to use the same solution because it's really easy to get around. And even in Europe, especially in Central Europe, there would be even more people just going around it, you know. So the same idea, like how to get the people who are coming there, coming to the sites many times a day, for example, how to get them paid. What we are doing is... on each site, we were especially seeking the kind of content that that is visited by most loyal readers, and for example, that has the lowest percentage of the, let's say, random visits.
You know, I saw that your press release here and was saying that this isn't, that you've netted over 40,000 euros so far. Does that money then get divided evenly amongst the amongst the companies that have your system, or is it divided proportionally based on traffic, or how does it work?
We don't divide the whole amount of money like based on some formula. We divide each individual payment. So if you pay 3 euros, we divide your 3 euros according to where you paid, on which site you paid, and where you spend your time. So if you just pay on one side, and if you are just using this one, then they get all the money. To pay on one side and then visit 3 others, then your money will be split between those 3 that you visited according to how much time you spend there.
All right, Tomasz Bela, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Tomasz Bela is the CEO of Piano Media. That's all for this week on Spectrum. Remember, you can always find us between shows at dw-world.de/science and on Twitter at dw_scitech. And you can always send me story tips, questions, comments, praise, or dissent via good old-fashioned email to feedback.english@dw-world.de. Also, please be sure to put Spectrum in the subject line. And don't forget about the Spectrum blog, which is available at blogs.dw-world.de/spectrum. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.